Welcome to BizRocket Radio with Stone Payton and John Baker. John Baker is a certified financial planner with a Master's of Science in Personal Financial Planning. Certified Financial Planner Board of Standards, Inc. owns the certification mark CFP, Certified Financial Planner, TM and CFP, and in the U.S., which it awards to individuals who successfully complete the CFP Board's initial and ongoing certification requirements. John Baker offers financial planning and securities through Woodbury Financial Services, Inc., a registered investment advisor and broker-dealer, member FINRA SIPC, located at 1050 Crown Point Parkway, Suite 1675, Atlanta, Georgia, 30338. This program is for information purposes only and should not be considered a solicitation of or offer to buy or offer to sell securities or investment advisory services. Information in this program regarding market or other financial information is obtained from sources which are believed to be reliable. We do not warrant or guarantee the timeliness or accuracy of this information. When considering any registered security products, seek a prospectus carefully before you invest. Make sure you consult your financial professional regarding any specific situation. And now, get ready for BizRocket Radio. Here's Stone Payton and John Baker.
Welcome to BizRocket Radio. This is John Baker, and I welcome you in to another wonderful day here in Atlanta, where we've gotten through the hot spell of May and the rain of beginning and middle of June, and we are sitting here pretty on this Wednesday morning. BizRocket Radio is a show where we get an opportunity to talk to executives and business owners here in the Atlanta area. And what we're trying to do is learn from their experiences and knowledge, successes, also their challenges that they've had. And today we've got a special guest. His name is Julius Pryor III. And Julius is the general managing partner for J. Pryor Group, LLC. And I have had the pleasure of seeing Julius speak at a meeting probably about a month ago, where he did a great job entertaining the crowd and delivering some good points of information. He's also an author, and we're going to get a chance to pick his brain a little bit this morning. So, Julius, welcome in.
Thanks. It's great to be here, John. I really appreciate you asking me into the studio today.
Yeah, it's our pleasure. So, Julius, let's start off with a little bit on your background. How did you kind of get to where you are right now, and what are you doing?
Well, it's something of an eclectic background. I'm a graduate of Morehouse College, which is right here in Atlanta. And shortly after graduating from Morehouse, I was trying to determine what I wanted to do for those next few years. And I knew I wanted to travel. I wanted to get some great leadership training. And I began to look at the military services, and the Navy was perfect for me because if you join the Navy, you literally do see the world. So I got a chance to do a lot of travel, got a chance to pick up a lot of great leadership experience, and it was really the first time in my life that I got a chance to mature and think about how I interacted with other people. So I spent time as an officer in the Navy, left active duty after a few years, and went to work for a number of corporations. In fact, the first company I went to work for was a joint venture between Abbott Laboratories and a big Japanese pharmaceutical company, Takeda. It was called TAP Pharmaceuticals. And we grew TAP from, I was the 50th employee hired, and we grew TAP from 50 people to about 3,500 and from about $100 million in sales to $2.5 billion. So that was really interesting. Most of the time I was there, I was in sales, national account management, and I began to move into what we refer to now as strategic diversity management. The president of the company actually asked me to create the first diversity strategy for the company, and I remember very clearly him bringing me to his office. In fact, he was the company was headquartered in Chicago, and he was in an MBA program at the University of Chicago. And even today, I'll tell him, remember, Alan, they were pointing a lot of knowledge, nonsense into your head. And, he said, yeah, all the stuff around diversity is becoming much more important. I'd like you to lead our effort. I said, Alan, I'll do it. This is an honor. And I walked out of his office, and I basically said, who did I piss off? Why is he asking me to do this?
Right.
And there was no place to go to get a degree in diversity management, so I really had to understand how to do this as I moved through various jobs. Left TAP Pharmaceuticals after 11 years and went to work for Russell Corporation, parent of Russell Athletic,
sure,
as their first diversity officer, and reported directly to the chairman and CEO, Jack Ward, who's a very good friend of mine today. We did a number of unique things there. Left Russell went to work for Johnson & Johnson and was the VP of Global Diversity for the Consumer Group and was doing a lot of work in the Pharma Group and in the Medical Devices Group. and left J&J to go to work for Coca-Cola Enterprises. The interesting thing is each of these jobs that I held was a newly created position. And in fact, my second day on the job, I was writing my job description. So I've had something of an eclectic career. I've really had an opportunity to work in a number of different functional areas with a number of different business entities. And my wife tells me today, when are you going to settle down and get a steady job?
And you say never.
Never.
This is what I got right now. It's steady. Steadily unsteady.
Right.
Yeah. So tell us about your experiences in this whole motivational speaking, because when you came out to speak to the group that I was involved in, that's kind of your gig now. Tell us more about that.
Yeah, I as I was preparing to leave Coke Enterprises, I was getting more and more opportunities to speak, to talk about topics that I was familiar with. And all of my life, I seemed to have been able to connect with people in a unique way that was able to make a difference, to have an impact. Even when I was in my corporate roles, I was the one who was always asked to go out and talk to various groups in the community, to talk to people in the organizations, to really deliver our strategy in a very concise and direct way. So this began to develop as a new opportunity for me. And I remember shortly after leaving Coke Enterprises, I got a call from the University of Toronto's Rotman School of Business, and they said, wow, we heard that I'd spoken a couple of times there when I was at Johnson & Johnson to their MBA students, and they called and said, we heard that you were out on your own now. We've been trying to get in touch with you. We'd really like you to come up and speak to our first-year MBA students, to the entering class. And I said, well, I'd be honored to do that. And they said, yeah, we'll take care of your airfare and your expenses. Now, what is your fee? What do you charge? And I hadn't even thought about it, John. And, and I said, well, how much you got? And that was the beginning of my formal career as a speaker and as a consultant.
Now, tell us about the company. What do you guys specialize in? Is there anything in particular that you tend to do a lot of besides speaking?
Yeah, J. Pryor Group, LLC, I still do a lot of work with organizations on helping them develop strategic diversity management plans and processes, really helping them understand how to leverage diversity towards business goals and objectives or towards developing a rationale that is very much connected to the values and mission of the organization, whether it's a nonprofit, a university. In fact, I helped Wake Forest University develop a strategic diversity plan for the entire university about a year ago. And, of course, if it's a for-profit corporation, to try to help them understand how you can utilize diversity and inclusion to actually drive revenue streams, market share gains, business goals and objectives. And the thing that disappoints me is I see a lot of people who are in these chief diversity officer roles in corporations, and I know a lot of them, who don't seem to yet still understand that there's a huge connection between how you can directly drive specific outcomes for a business entity if you effectively leverage diversity by looking at not only the workplace, but the workforce, the marketplace, understanding how things are shifting from a global perspective. And that's one of the things that J. Pryor Group LLC does. And then again, I do a lot of motivational speaking. I have a number of unique topics, talk a lot about things that have occurred in my life and how those things are useful in terms of thinking about how you can move forward, develop a better team, develop an elastic kind of command so that you're moving in from the middle of the team to actually leading the team. And I've recently partnered with a HR team and a law firm to help organizations with labor issues, with labor law, and with a range of HR functions. And the name of the HR company that I'm a partner in now is OneSource HRM. And we're doing some very unique things with a range of HR functions for large organizations.
So let me just take a step back for listeners that may be new to the concept of diversity or to that whole line of thinking or business development. Tell us more about that.
Well, a lot of people, when they hear the word diversity, and I often lead a dialogue with organizations or with leadership teams, and the first thing I say is, well, we're having a dialogue around diversity. Define diversity for me.
Right.
And usually I get a different answer from everyone in the room. And I said, this indicates that you don't have a strategic approach. You should at least have a common definition for talking about diversity within the context of your own organization. And oftentimes we talk about diversity in terms of differences, the different things that people bring to the table. Dr. Roosevelt Thomas Jr., who's done a lot of academic work in this area and has brought a lot of academic rigor to the work, defines diversity as any collective mixture characterized by differences and similarities. So we bring a lot of unique things to the table, but we also have a number of ties that bind us together. Then again, if you think about market-driven companies, you have to be sure that you're understanding the shifting demographics of the marketplace from a regional, national, and global perspective. You have to be sure that you're accessing the right kind of talent, that you're accessing the best and brightest talent, and increasingly, that talent is beginning to come in a number of different packages. The last thing that's critically important is understanding how to leverage that talent to actually drive specific business goals and objectives. And when I was at Johnson & Johnson, we actually drove a major product acquisition out of things that we did within the Office of Diversity. And again, utilizing the Office of Diversity almost as a profit center is something that I've continued to try to stress to people to think about how you can drive clearly defined outcomes by leveraging and utilizing diversity and inclusion as indeed a business driver.
Tell me a little bit more about how you see diversity in age being something. It seems to be a major stepping stone right now where the baby boomer generation, and then you
right.
move all the way to people that are graduating from college, which have been raised with a BlackBerry or with a with an iPhone in their hand. I mean, literally, my 3-year-old can do more on the iPad than I can. I mean, he, you know, it's and obviously the other kids have just been raised with this stuff. What does youth provide to diversity that you found in the experiences that you've had?
Well, it's interesting because you have a number of different generational categories within the workforce today. Everybody from the people that we refer to as veterans, who were the World War II generation and the pre-boomers, the baby boomer generation that continues to talk so much about itself. Well, we continue to talk so much about ourselves.
That's right.
Millennials, Gen Xers, and a group that I'm referring to as Gen Texters. And then you have what I refer to as what a number of people refer to as digital immigrants,
yeah.
and I put myself in that category, and then you just talked about your children, I talk about my sons
yeah.
in the same way. They're digital natives.
Yeah.
So you're right, we have a number of different groups within the workforce, but the thing that disturbs me is we like to paint with a broad brush based on chronological age, when indeed the people who basically created a number of the computer platforms that we're talking about today, Steve Jobs and Bill Gates, are baby boomers. So,
yeah.
You really need to understand that we sort of flow back and forth between these categories, and ultimately what we're trying to do is be sure that we're developing effective and efficient teams that can drive clarity throughout an organization and drive goals and objectives. And again, something that I talk about in the book, in fact, the first concept that I talk about in the book is clarity, helping an organization get clear about what it is they're trying to do, whether it is within the context of a diversity and inclusion strategy or in the context of simply what are we here to do every day, is critically important. So I try to bring all of those concepts to bear when I'm talking to a leadership team about diversity and inclusion. And companies come to diversity in either one of two ways. They're either in pain or they're doing it because they have a vision. Unfortunately, a lot of times, and I guess the one of the big examples of recent years was Coca-Cola. They had a big discrimination lawsuit, and they had to really look at diversity first from the perspective of race and gender to a certain degree. What I really want organizations to do is to think about how can we utilize this? How can we leverage all of these different categories of people and different demographic groups that we have in our organization? How can we understand our marketplace in a much better way? How can we effectively utilize people and functional areas to be sure that we're driving towards specific goals? And so I really like to take a much more global viewpoint when I talk about diversity and inclusion. And unfortunately, I think too many people are still stuck with talking about diversity purely from a workforce representation or a perspective of pluralism.
When you translate this information into mm-hmm. your motivational talks, mm-hmm. what are the points that you really drive home? What are the things that you're trying to get across when you're doing we were talking before we got on air on a job that you just got back from, 800 people that came to a convention. What are you trying to get across to those guys?
Well, it was interesting. One of the examples that I used was a recent, when I was in the Navy, I had an opportunity to do some exercises and training evolutions with some of the members of the SEAL teams. And I gave an example of a recent SEAL team mission. A lot of the work that they do is often hidden. They're in the shadows. But every now and then, they have a high-profile mission that pops up into the news cycle. The recent takedown of OBL, Osama bin Laden, was one. And 3 years ago, there was an anti-piracy task force that the U.S. Navy was the centerpiece for. And a merchant ship captain was taken hostage, the SS Alabama, a Maersk liner. And the SEALs had to be called in. The Navy was at the centerpiece, was at the center of this, trying to rescue this U.S. Merchant ship captain that had been taken hostage. And just talking about all of the aspects that were involved in that mission, and I wasn't specifically talking about diversity, but when I wrapped it up, I talked about how this team came together. Not only the SEALs, who have very unique and different backgrounds and specialized skills, but also the larger military organization. They were relying on the Navy, the Air Force, the Marines. The Army, to a certain degree, was involved. Then NATO forces, other Navy. So there was a much larger extended team that was involved. And how do you get all of those people to come together
right.
to accomplish a mission? And then I wrapped it up by explaining to everyone that the person who was actually in charge of this entire task force was an African-American female admiral. Her name is Michelle Howard. And she reported to this anti-piracy task force to be in charge of it about 5 days before Richard Phillips, the merchant ship captain, was taken hostage. And again, she had to make all the right decisions. She had to determine who to put on station, which assets to utilize, to get command authority from the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, from the commander-in-chief, to keep everyone informed. And that means that she had to really understand exactly what a leader is supposed to do in that kind of situation, how to delegate authority, how to be sure that she was doing everything that she needed to do to get this guy out of this hostage situation without getting him killed. And the question that I asked everyone as I presented this story is, how does she get to the position that she's in? And when you look at a picture of her, she's about 4 feet tall. She looks like a hobbit. She's not the typical stereotypical image of a warrior. And yet she did everything that she needed to do as a very strong military leader to deliver results in this situation. And again, as I talk to people through that scenario, I say, when you think about what was required for her to get here, corporations can go out and hire a VP of sales or a senior vice president of IT or a chief financial officer if they need one. If you're in the military, and especially in the Navy, you can't go out and hire a rear admiral. And the rank she was at was 2-star, which is rear admiral upper half. You have to grow these people from day one in the organization. And she was a midshipman at the Naval Academy. She had to do a division officer tour, a department head tour, an executive officer tour, a commanding officer tour. And she had to continually deliver results at each step of the way. And whenever I ask the question, people often say, well, we know what was required for her to do well. She had to deliver results. She had to persevere. She had to be very good at her job. She had to understand how to be strategic and tactical. And I said, yeah, but what else was involved? And typically people miss the thing that I think is most important and is most important when you think about developing a strategic approach to diversity and inclusion. In other words, the organization wanted her to succeed. The Navy wanted her to do well from day one. As soon as they realized she had potential, and if you meet the requirements to get in, we assume that you have potential, they wanted to be sure that she did well. In the typical large corporate environment, you may get some mentoring as you become much more senior in the organization or are in charge of an important functional group or an operating division. They were mentoring her from day one. In fact, I don't even use the word mentoring. I say she was being nurtured to be a good leader in this organization. And her story is not that different from many other Navy officers that I've talked to, or even my story. And in fact, when I reported to my first ship, I had to meet the ship in the Philippines. We had to leave port early because there was a storm on the way in, and we weren't more than 15 feet away from the pier, and I was seasick. We hadn't even gotten into blue water yet, and I was seasick.
Right.
And as we headed out to avoid this typhoon, I felt increasingly worse. I was up on the bridge, my first time meeting the commanding officer and my department head, and I literally puked my guts out. And I said, this is it. I'm not going to get promoted. I certainly am not going to make it all the way to captain. I'll be lucky if I make it to Lieutenant JG. I'll be an ensign for the rest of my life. But the captain looked at me and laughed and said, clean your shirt off. You've got the next watch. And we expect you to be up to speed and understand how to stand this watch on your own within about a month. So again, the organization said, you've met the basic requirements. We expect you to do well, and we're going to ensure that you do well. And I had a lot of help all along the way. So a number of lessons come out of that story about the Navy SEALs, because it shows how the Navy takes people who we would consider unconventional in terms of being leaders and really mold and develop them to be leaders. It shows that they take anyone to do the job who has the abilities to do the job, in this case an African-American woman who's now a very capable rear admiral in the Navy, and that they can pull people from very disparate backgrounds to function as an extremely capable and efficient team. At one point, there was concern when they realized that they were going to have to, they couldn't negotiate their way out of this. They realized they were going to probably have to use deadly force to take these pirates out to get the captain free. They had to take a shot from the fantail of the Bainbridge, which was the Arleigh Burke destroyer that was on station. The captain was in a small boat with three Somali pirates. The boat was moving. The fantail of the destroyer was moving. The pirates were moving around inside the lifeboat that was being towed behind the Bainbridge. And everyone was concerned. Is this going to go down in a hail of bullets? Are we going to end up killing the hostage? And the SEAL team commander basically explained to the commanding officer, look, if there are three pirates, it shouldn't take us more than three shots to do this. We're very skilled. We're very well trained. And the difference between us and anybody with a bunch of weapons is that we're very efficient with force. We understand how to do what we need to do. And again, those are things that are inherent when you think about diversity and inclusion. So I like to take a very unconventional approach to help people think about how they're actually leveraging and managing diversity in their lives every day. And even if you talk about the fact that we have these children, you talked about your kids, I've talked about my sons. Anybody who's dealing with kids is managing diversity every day of their lives.
No doubt, no doubt. So let's shift a little bit to the book. Mm-hmm. And in looking at the book, there's a lot in reference to the number six.
Right.
What is that all about?
Well, from the minute that I realized I wanted to do this, I said I want to market it globally. Six is actually a fortuitous number. It's a lucky number. It means good luck in China. It's a good number for business in China. And I said, well, I've got six concepts here. Why not position the book to do well in China and some of the other Asia-Pac markets? So the number six is really unique. Six is the only number that's both the sum and product of three successive positive numbers. In other words, one times two times three is six. One plus two plus three is six. Extrasensory perception is referred to as the sixth sense. NAV Dev Group, which is Naval Special Warfare Development Group, is often referred to by their nickname, SEAL Team 6. And 6 is just a very unique number in terms of how you think about it. So there were a number of reasons that I used that, and one of those reasons was I talk about six core concepts in the book.
So let's talk about those concepts, maybe without spoiling the book for the publisher.
Well, the first concept is clarity. The second concept that I talk about is what I call the second concept is actually what I call quantum thinking. The third concept is hyper-collaboration, and again, the Navy SEALs are an example of a hyper-collaborative team. I also talk about the New England Patriots and a NASCAR pit crew in the book. Mm-hmm. The fourth concept is agility. The fifth is passion, which is something I think is required to do well in a job or to move forward in life. And the sixth concept ties everything together, and that is faith. If your faith is strong, it sustains you. And there are a number of unique ways to think about faith. But I'll tell you a quick story about clarity. And I sort of opened the book with this story. And I'm talking about a guy named Jim. He works in his family's business. He's going to inherit a very large fortune when his sickly father passes away. And his father doesn't have very long to live, and he finally decides that he needs a wife with which to share this great fortune he's about to inherit. And one evening at an investment meeting, he meets this beautiful woman. Her beauty literally takes his breath away, John. He approached her. He told her, look, I may not look like much, But in a few months, my father's going to pass away, and I'm going to inherit close to $1 billion. She was impressed. She took his business card. And 6 days later, she became his stepmother. So I always give people a minute or two to sort of take that in.
Right.
But again, this tells us two things. First of all, that women are much better at estate planning than men, which is something that you know quite a bit about, Sean.
Yep.
And but the big lesson is clarity, being absolutely clear about what you want, clarity of intentions. And if you think about what this guy did, he never actually said, hey, I'd like you to marry me. He gave this long story, and she said, well, why should I?
I go direct to the source.
Yeah, why not go direct to the source? So, and
a
I think that
commitment, too.
I think corporations, and I've worked for some very good ones, but even within those organizations, it was sometimes difficult to help everyone across the enterprise understand what we were there to do every day, to get clear about our vision and mission, to really get clear about what we were there to do on a quarterly basis and long term. So clarity is critically important. Quantum thinking is something else that I refer to that I think is very important. And we know a lot about analytical thinking, which is based on facts and data. We talk today to a certain degree about conceptual thinking, which looks at a larger picture. But I really give some examples of quantum thinking in the book, which allows you to really look at disparate points of information and pull those things together in a way that allows you to see around corners, to see what's underneath the table, and to really see through the clutter. Mm. And in the environments that we're working in today, there's a lot of clutter. If you just take a look at the internet on any given day, there's a lot of crap on it. How do you see through the clutter? How can you get through all of this subterfuge to actually understand what's going on? You think about companies like IBM and what they're doing with analytics right now. They're basically betting the future of the company on being able to do what I refer to as quantum thinking. The third concept talks about hyper-collaboration, and I think I've given a good example of that with the SEALs. There are other examples in the book. The other concept is around agility, and then there are really good stories around agility in the book and some great things about passion and how you can leverage passion to drive towards results. And then I give some very unique parables about faith.
Well, give me an example.
Well, let me tell you something else about hyper-collaboration. And then if we have time, I'll talk a little bit about faith. But one of the things I talk about in the book is how the New England Patriots have been so successful over the last decade. They've always been in the top five of finishers when it came to looking at the most successful NFL teams. And, in fact, they've been in the Super Bowl now five of those ten years as we look over the last 10 years. And there's some sort of unique things about the Patriots that I thought were very relevant in terms of how they really pull together and are so tight as a team. One of the things, again, is clarity of objectives, clear and concise communications. But the two biggest things, in addition to being super focused on details and being very disciplined, is that they have a lot of turnover. Sometimes they have 70% turnover in any given year, but the core of the team stays the same. And team results in their culture are valued as opposed to individual accomplishments. The other thing is they always have been able to exploit small gaps in their adversaries, even when they have certain weaknesses themselves. This year, they didn't have a very strong defense, but yet they were able to leverage the people that they had on the team to exploit those small gaps. And again, they made it all the way to the Super Bowl. They didn't win, but they only lost by 4 points. They were in the game right until the last moment. The other thing that you really see that's unique in hyper-collaborative teams, and you see this a lot in SEALs, is what I call elasticity of command. Anyone can move into a leadership role as circumstances change. And in fact, within the course of a mission, you may have different people moving in and out of the center of the team to lead the team, depending on what they're doing at a particular point in the mission. The final thing that's critically important when you talk about hyper-collaborative teams, in addition to their constant training, practice, and development, is that, again, the organization, the culture, is supportive of their succeeding. Mm-hmm. One of the things that the SEALs did a number of years ago, and if you think about what we do in corporations, we will spend 30% of our time in meetings, 30% of our time doing administrative work, and maybe, if we're lucky, 20 to 30% of our time doing productive work. The SEALs said if we're going to be successful, we need to basically develop a separate command to handle administrative work so we can spend 80 to 90% of our time when we're not on a mission training.
so many good nuggets that you have there. I mean, the six concepts, mm-hmm. The stories that you've got are fantastic. Tell me more about who your client would be. Who would be somebody that should pick up the phone and say, "Look, Julius, I need you to come either help us with diversity or help me with some motivational speaking." Who would be your perfect client?
Well, any corporation that's trying to get better in terms of being more effective in when they think about how they utilize teams, how they're deploying assets. In the Navy, we refer to ships and aircraft and people as assets. But basically, how do you effectively leverage and utilize your people so that they are focused on goals and objectives, so that they are passionate about what they're doing, and so that they really understand what the goals and objectives of the organization are from a large perspective, and then from what they're doing within their individual functional areas from day to day. So I would say that an ideal client would be any number of organizations. And again, I've done work for large corporations, Fortune 50, Fortune 500 companies. I've helped universities and nonprofits develop strategies. So basically, the client is anyone who has people. Anyone who has, I guess we refer to them as human resources, but they're people. And most organizations talk about amateurization, and they look at buildings and capital outlays and equipment and computers. And we often say that our most valuable resources are our people. Well, guess what? Those valuable resources drive out the company's gates every day. And good leaders and organizations understand that it's their job to bring them back the next day. So understanding how to effectively get people to want to be there and to feel that they're doing something that actually delivers a result, that has an impact, that's making a difference, is critically important. And those are the things that I deliver. So, yeah, we talk about developing a diversity strategy. We talk about developing business strategies, really, with a twist on diversity. But ultimately, we're talking about being effective and being sure that people actually feel passionate about what they're doing every day.
Perfect. So let's wrap up with a final question that I'd like to throw out there to all my guests, which is your pearl of wisdom. If you had one pearl of wisdom to put out there to our listeners, what would it be?
I quote a number of very profound thinkers in the book. I guess that I will... I'll tell you a quick story about Marcus Allen. A lot of people may not know who he is, but Marcus Allen was a Heisman Trophy winner out of USC, University of Southern California Trojans. He went to play for a number of years with the Los Angeles Raiders and the Oakland Raiders and the Kansas City Chiefs. And he was a very, very good running back.
He killed my Redskins in the Super Bowl.
He killed a lot of teams in the Super Bowl. He was MVP, I think his second year in the league, and won the Super Bowl, was on a Super Bowl winning Raiders team his first or second year in the league.
And my best friend was a huge Raiders fan. He's never going to let me forget it. So I don't really like Marcus.
Silver and black. But Marcus Allen, about midway through his career, he began to pick up karate lessons. And a number of his teammates were saying, why are you doing this? Are you trying to figure out how to defend yourself? And he said, no, I really want it for the spiritual centeredness that it gives me. I'm looking as a way to meditate, to stay focused. And I also like the fact that it really helps with body control. And if you notice what he did, especially after he began to take these lessons in the martial arts, whenever he was tackled, he always managed to fall forward. He twisted his body in a way so that he fell forward and usually was able to pick up another 2 or 3 yards in terms of how the referees placed the ball. There was one game in the latter stages of his career where the Raiders were trying to get to the playoffs, and it came down to one or two last plays, and he had been given the ball. They were close to the end zone. They were about 10 feet away. They got up to about the 8-yard line, and they had about 20 seconds, and the clock was about to tick down. And again, he got the call. The ball was given to Marcus. He juked left. He twisted right. He found a little gap in the line. But he was tackled about 2 feet from the goal line. And as he fell down, he somehow managed to twist and pull. And the headline in the newspapers the next day said, Marcus Allen has head, shoulders, and football across the goal line as Raiders win and go into playoffs. And again, the pearl of wisdom from that is that even if you fall flat on your face, as long as you fall forward, you're making progress.
All right. That's sage advice. I like it. So, Julius, if somebody is trying to find somebody in the role that you fill and would like to reach out to you or maybe just has questions, how would they best get in contact with you?
Yeah, my website address is www.juliuspryor.com. That's J-U-L-I-U-S, P as in Papa, R-Y-O-R, www.juliuspryor.com. My email address is jpryor@jp3rd.com. And I have a Twitter following now that's jpryor3rd, jpryor3rd at Twitter. So you can reach me in any of those ways. My phone number is 404-702-8060. All of those things are on my website. You can Google me. There's plenty of information on me on
LinkedIn,
the web.
LinkedIn, the whole
LinkedIn,
nine yards.
I'm out there.
All right.
So it's been great talking to you.
Yeah, you too. So it's JP3, not RG3. But are you
no.
getting, you're getting any extra hits because of some extra? You
no.
Know, no, nothing. Nothing.
No,
extra.
In fact, I seem to be pretty well positioned on the web right now.
All right. Well, Julius, great talking to you. Thanks for taking the time to share some of that information with our listeners. And for our listeners, we appreciate your time and tuning in. Until next week, be safe.
John Baker is a certified financial planner with a Master's of Science in Personal Financial Planning. Certified Financial Planner Board of Standards, Inc. owns the certification mark CFP, Certified Financial Planner, TM and CFP, and in the U.S., which it awards to individuals who successfully complete the CFP Board's initial and ongoing certification requirements. John Baker offers financial planning and securities through Woodbury Financial Services, Inc., a registered investment advisor and broker-dealer, member FINRA/SIPC, located at 1050 Crown Point Parkway, Suite 1675, Atlanta, Georgia, 30338. This program is for information purposes only and should not be considered a solicitation of or offer to buy or offer to sell securities or investment advisory services. Information in this program regarding market or other financial information is obtained from sources which are believed to be reliable. We do not warrant or guarantee the timeliness or accuracy of this information. When considering any registered security products, seek a prospectus carefully before you invest. Make sure you consult your financial professional regarding any specific situation.